In AD 1377, William Langland made a passing reference to the rhymes of Robin Hood. By 1600, there were over 200 references to the legendary character. Scottish historians wrote about him. People named stones, caves, and ships after the outlaw. Officials referred to real outlaws as Robin Hoods, and other outlaws took the name of Robin and his men. But who this Robin Hood really was, and whether or not he was fictional, mythological, or real, is far less important or interesting than what his character meant for people over the centuries and how his story was adapted to fit each culture and generation. At times, he was a trickster. Other times, he was a soldier. At other times, he was a rebel or a lord. His story is familiar to all of us. He lives in the woods with his merry men. He challenges the wrongful authority of the Sheriff of Nottingham, and he robs from the rich to give to the poor. Yet this familiarity disguises the evolution of the legend. For as societies have changed down the centuries, so has Robin Hood. For what defines wrongful authority? What constitutes rebellion? And is it ever justified or even necessary? The answers depend on the cultures, the values, ethics, and belief systems of any given time. In the earliest plays about Robin Hood, he's no knight fallen on hard times, nor a nobleman denied his birthright. Instead, he is a man of the people, a yeoman, which is one level up from a peasant. Stories about Robin were spread by word of mouth among ordinary people, and it was at a time when they needed a hero. The Black Death and other plagues had ravaged 14th century England. Civil war followed. Millions were killed or displaced. The Robin Hood story is very much a story of ordinary people against authority. In the 16th century, England became a Protestant nation. And as the country changed, so did the stories about Robin Hood. Soon it was not only the Sheriff of Nottingham that he fought, but corrupt Catholic priests as well. Under Queen Elizabeth I, however, authorities grew concerned. This legendary man of the people became too popular. Robin Hood, they decided, was a threat to their power and authority, and efforts were made to suppress the stories. If Robin Hood was to survive, they would have to change again. And his savior was the Elizabethan playwright, Anthony Munday. He transformed the outlaw from a yeoman to the Earl of Huntingdon, a fallen member of the aristocracy. This changed the target of Robin Hood's rebellion. In Munday's telling, the outlaw's conflict was with corrupt authority, not correct authority. He was now a member of the aristocracy himself and a loyal servant to the true king. Robin became a representative of legitimate authority, and every time he defied the rules of his fictional world, he reinforced the social structures of the Elizabethan period. The next great shift came in the 19th century. 19th century Britain had a fascination with the medieval past. Robin became a literary figure, a popular figure, and once that happens, you get this new romantic Robin Hood, who is very much loved by all. He's loved by women, he's very charming, he's loved by men as a dashing and daring hero, and he's a true monarchist, which is very important in the expanding British Empire. In the 20th century, Robin Hood would reach Hollywood. Since his earlier appearances in silent films, there have been dozens of screen adaptations for Robin Hood. These depictions vary decade by decade, but they always challenge the pressing issues of the day. And we continue year after year, to revisit the story and recraft it for our own age, for the appeal of Robin Hood seems undimmed by time. Now, you're probably wondering, why are we talking about Robin Hood? Perhaps you've surmised that the character himself is not really important. It's about the listening and reading audience. What's important here is how we don't just parrot stories word for word, memories for memories, down through the centuries and millennia. We adapt them as we need to make sense of our own time. And that's exactly what mythology is, the story of people used to help them understand the bigger questions of life and death, love and war, meaning and meaninglessness. And of course, the Bible stories too were crafted and recrafted, purposed and repurposed, shaped and reshaped to fit an infinite number of time periods in Israel's history. We know that most of the Bible was assembled after the Israelites returned from captivity in about 500 BC. Prior to that, there was very little writing in Israel's community. So they were word-of-mouth stories that were finally put together and written down. Formally, the stories of creation, Tower of Babel, Joseph and his coat of many colors coming out of Egypt, Moses and his fellow Hebrews crossing the dry sea into the wilderness, etc., were old stories, told and retold, written down in various versions. But when the Tanakh, or the Old Testament, was formally compiled, the stories and narratives had gone through many revisions as they were used by successive generations to explain who they were as a people, God's people, in a very hostile region of the world. And why does that matter? Because we need to adapt those stories for today. We need to glean the spiritual, moral, and ethical principles for our lives in 2026. In the early Christian church, the narrative moved from ancient Israel to Jesus. He became the next episode in the series, you could say. From there, Jesus was identified as a new kind of Moses, as Elijah 2.0, a transformed concept of what Israel expected from a Messiah, and even a new version of Adam. I'm sure you've heard many times that when we attempt to understand the Bible, there are some things we have to do when we read something. Who wrote the particular passage being considered? What do we know about Paul as a person? And why would he write in that style? What do we know about King David? And why would he have written what he wrote? That's an important piece. Who was the audience? What was the context of what was written, including the culture, the problem being addressed by what was written, or the general understanding of the story by the people who first heard it? What would they have heard the person say? And then how do we properly translate the ancient languages into today's modern language? That can be very challenging. But just as importantly, we need to find out if there's any direct application of those texts, all of them, any of them, for our lives today. We don't just read it as an interesting ancient document. We read it and we wonder, what can we apply from this? What can we learn from this? How does this speak to us in 2026? I think the general principle is found in 2 Timothy 3:16, where it says, all scripture at some level, at some time, is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine. So that's your belief system. But it's also profitable for reproof and correction, so that when we read it, we say, in my situation, in my life today, I'm facing a similar situation, and here's the application. And for instruction in righteousness. not how was this instruction for righteousness just for Israelites or just for Greeks hearing Paul's message, but what instructions in righteousness is there for me and for us as a group? The stories and characters and situations in the ancient text are meant to inform and inspire us today and tomorrow. Every age has interpreted God and his word to suit their own personal and community circumstances and need. Now, please hear me correctly. I am not saying that we recreate God in our own image, age after age after age. That's not what I'm saying. It's more a matter of isolating the particular attributes of God and the scriptures that we're reading and applying them directly to our current situation. For example, when Israel and Judah were surrounded by aggressive nation states and empires, they cried out to Yahweh Sabaoth, literally translated as Lord of Armies. Now, you and I today probably don't dwell a great deal on the attribute of God and his designation as Lord of Armies. We're not under attack. We're not in a situation where we need someone to come and defeat an enemy, speaking of nations and empires. So we're more likely to focus on the attributes of God of forgiveness, grace, healing, wisdom, etc. When Israel and Judah's leaders were struggling to combat the allure of pagan gods and forms of worship, they highlighted that their God was El Elyon, which means Lord of Lords, King of Kings, the God above all other gods, the Most High God. So that attribute of God fit their need because of their circumstances, because they're dealing with a lot of pagan distraction. Jesus himself is understood and worshipped very differently from age to age. We see this quite often in writings about him and particularly in art. In the first few centuries, he was commonly depicted as the Good Shepherd, a beardless, youthful man carrying a sheep on his shoulders, drawing on familiar Greek and Roman motifs like Apollo and Orpheus. As Christianity became the state religion of the Roman Empire, depictions of Jesus changed to reflect his divine authority. The youthful shepherd was largely replaced by the Christ Pantocrator, that is, Christ ruler of all, became more of an authority figure than a caring figure. The other aspect of Jesus wasn't lost, it's just that's not the focus of that age and that time period. This version of Jesus featured a somber, bearded face, a halo, dark flowing hair, and one hand raised in blessing, a style heavily influenced by classical Greco-Roman portrayals of divine power. And as the medieval church grew, the focus shifted from Jesus' humanity and suffering to connect with a largely illiterate population and communities ravaged by events like the Black Death, which killed almost half the population of Europe. And of course, they're wanting to know from the church, why is this happening? What are we doing wrong to displease God? Why won't God intervene to stop this? And so art increasingly highlighted the emotional and physical pain of the crucifixion to show Jesus as, well, maybe this is God's allowing this to happen, but he's been through this himself. Jesus has also suffered. He's also borne our pain. This period emphasized a relatable, sorrowful God who shared in human suffering. In the 19th and 20th centuries, up to today, as Christianity became a global religion, Jesus began to be depicted with the distinct cultural, racial, and ethnic features of each region, whether that be Africa, Asia, Middle East. So I'd like to ask you to think about how you personally embrace and adapt the biblical stories for your own life and your own spiritual development. What really speaks to you? Who are your, I hate to use the word heroes, but who inspires you? Who do you go to when you need courage, when you need faith, when you need encouragement and direction in your life? What qualities and attributes of God and Jesus do you especially cherish? And how has that changed over time as a Christian? We can learn today, and in every age, for example, from Jonah, that God offers grace to all, even his enemies, and so should we. The story of Lot's wife can be understood through the lens of the addictive and alluring nature of modern culture and even our obsession with social media. When we read of David's defeat over the Philistine Goliath, can we gain strength and encouragement from knowing that our battles may be more than we can face at work, at school, at home, but for those who put their trust in the Lord, victory can still be ours despite overwhelming odds? We may use words for comfort today that were given to someone thousands of years ago. Imagine the power that those words carry forward, generation after generation. Over 540 years before the birth of Jesus, during the Jewish exile in Babylon, the prophet Isaiah wrote the following to comfort the people found in Isaiah 41, verse 10. So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. 2,500 years ago, that was written, approximately. Over 2,500 years after those words were written, those same words were handed to Michael Jackson by his mother, just before he headed into court to face a jury in a court case that could have seen him spend the rest of his days in jail. Those ancient words still spoke in modern times, adapted and reshaped for one person at a time to address their unique faith challenge. I want to leave you today with words we already sang, but I want you to let those words really sink in as a message for our lives today. Holy words long preserved for our walk in this world. They resound with God's own heart. Let the ancient words impart. Words of life, words of hope, they give us strength and help us cope. In this world, wherever we roam, these ancient words will guide us home.